Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, as usual, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we've got a very special program in store for you today. We're going to do an interview with a guy who, he sort of does what I do. He is a guy who has an intense and eclectic interest in all things alternative and in the field of nutrition, and he spends hours and hours a day compiling articles and sharing them with listeners and subscribers. And I have to say that he has been a major source of information for me. Many of the stories that I share with you on Intelligent Medicine on the podcast and also on my program Health Talk, I source them by following the posts and summaries and great articles by this individual. He's incredibly dedicated. I don't think a single health story has escaped his notice in the past two or three decades. And so I'm going to introduce him. He is Kirk Hamilton. Kirk has recently written a great book for the general public called Staying Healthy in the Fast Lane. He's been a practicing physician's assistant working in nutrition and prevention and integrative medicine for a long time. He actually started the same year that I started, in 1983. Wow. But his, Kirk, welcome to the program. Yeah.
Welcome, Dr. Hoffman.
we couldn't suppress that wow, because, you know, I've known you for so many years and have seen you at meetings, and in some ways we've had parallel careers. You've been educating not just the public, but also health professionals. I would say that there are thousands of health professionals across the country who rely on your wonderful summaries of nutrition and prevention research. You've got newsletters, books, databases, and this is actually, I would say this is a program for real aficionados. And during this interview, we're going to turn you on to some, if you're really into this and not just a casual listener to Intelligent Medicine, you want to go further and you want to enrich your knowledge about nutrition, this is a guy you really need to know about, and we're going to tell you a little bit about some of his the information that he puts out. Kirk works; he still works with patients, but he also does a lot of teaching and writing and health promotion. And he also has an audio podcast called Staying Healthy Today, and he publishes interviews and also has audio interviews with experts on a wide variety of health topics. So if somebody's writing, a fantastic article about the benefits of, let's say, folic acid, he's gonna be right on top of it, and he's gonna talk to that guy, regardless of whether the guy is in Chicago or whether the guy is in Cairo or Istanbul, Paris. He's gonna track this person down, and he's going to interview them and get their opinions on very important issues related to nutrition. So if you're not blushing by now, Kirk, you can join the conversation.
Well, you've embellished. I thank you very much, and I appreciate that. You know, I've changed a little bit from what you said, so if I can clarify a few
things. Sure, please do. Yeah,
okay?
Go ahead.
So, yeah, we did start at the same time. I graduated through the UC Davis program in a physician assistant program in 1983, and immediately worked in an integrated medicine practice in Marina Del Rey, California. The database, the Clinical Pearls database, which you share, that really started in 1987, and I did that from 1987 through 2004. And basically what that was is I would review maybe, 1,000 table of contents, and I'd pull out a couple hundred articles, summarize them, and then put them in a newsletter format, interviews, et cetera, and annual books. But in 2004, the company now, I actually sold that database to Tishcon Corporation, who I am internally gratefully thankful because
makers of coenzyme Q10.
One of the best coenzyme Q10s anywhere, and very great people. And they actually did what I couldn't do. They put together the database in an electronic format and made it free. So today, that whole database, when I sold it to them, there's probably, 30,000 articles, and now there's probably 40,000 article summaries that you talk about. And so they do the summaries now, and what I do now is I continue to do the interviews, the expert interviews. So if you go, there's over 1,000 interviews that I've done of the most scientific research. I mean, they're really, these are real hardcore scientists, but They are focused on nutrition and nutritional pharmacology and nutrition preventive medicine research. So I just want to give, I have to give Tishkan all the credit sure. in the world because they kept it going. Because I couldn't.
I actually feel better now because if you were engaged in minutely reading and reporting on each and every one of those articles, I would just say, get a life. So I'm glad that you sold that part of the business and that you now are concentrating on interviews because it would be such a monumental task what they do. And for our listeners, especially people who are real aficionados, and you know, we also have a lot of health professionals who listen to this podcast. If you really want the 411 on health issues, go to vitasearch.com, and vitasearch.com has, say you want to look up the relationship between folic acid and Alzheimer's disease. All the articles on folic acid and Alzheimer's disease, they have a searchable database. You write folic acid, Alzheimer's disease, and boom, you'll see a printout of all the articles. And then if your doctor says, oh, there's no evidence that folic acid is beneficial for prevention of Alzheimer's disease, you'll say, yes, but I just found 60 articles on that.
Well, the beauty of that database really is a time saver. And what I mean by that is you could probably find those articles in PubMed or wherever. But the whole premise of Clinical Pearls originally was to save doctors time. One of the premises. The other was that we were doing some peer-reviewed medicine. We're not doing, you know, out there in left field medicine, but we only have so much time in a day, so you're going to get a higher amount of hits of clinically relevant nutritional articles per question if you go to the VitaSearch database, which is the Clinical Pearls database, and then they're connected to the 1,000 plus interviews that I continue to do, so that's all in one database. And you know, the interviews are very special to me in that, you know, when I first started, the real reason I did it was, you know, I wanted us to be credible. And I talk about you, Dr. Hoffman, and everybody else. You know, we always got thrown under the bus, so to speak. And then there was a reason, probably because we did stuff, you know, just because we did stuff. But as science grew, you know, there was data behind it. And so what I wanted to do was to take away the argument from traditional medicine that I was getting this from an alternative source, because it's not. It was a regular medical journal, that the researcher was some kind of supplement company owner or something like that that was so biased. These are hardcore researchers at every academic institution. And therefore, what I want is people just to look at the data without all their biases. And if it's, you know, if the nutrition doesn't work, then it doesn't work. But if it works, it should be part of real medicine, not alternative medicine, but this is real medicine. And that's why I think the interviews are so powerful, because you'll see where they come from, the academic institutions. You'll see the medical journal. First off, you'll have contact information and all their credentials. And then you get into the nutrition study that they did. So that's why I love doing those, and I love connecting the world. I mean, I've done interviews in the USSR to, you know, China to all over, the print ones. And that's really wonderful. It's kind of a unique thing.
So you must be particularly aggrieved when folks like Dr. Paul Offit, you know, recently we talked about him because he's been all over the airways. He's gotten all kinds of access to mainstream journalistic outlets, newspapers and TV programs, where he gets on the air and he says, look, there's no such thing as alternative medicine. There's either mainstream medicine, which works, which is mostly pharmacologically based. By the way, his background is in vaccine development, and he's a big believer in administering vaccines. The alternative medicine, there really should not be any such thing as alternative medicine. And he poo-poos the use of vitamins and nutrients, saying, essentially, there's no science. If there was science behind it, then we would be using these things. Mainstream medicine would be embracing these things. What do you have to say to the naysayers who say, well, you know, essentially, there's no science behind this?
Well, here's the way I would couch it. I personally don't like the term alternative medicine. As I share with you, I feel like I'm doing real medicine.
Yep.
So, for example, one interview that I was writing a letter for to get was an article on sepsis in the hospital, and carnitine was a therapy. Now, that's as hardcore medicine as they get, critical care. And they were giving carnitine to help reduce the susceptibility to sepsis and actually treat septic shock. So that's medicine. Now, that's using a nutrient as a drug in a sense. But so what I'm saying is that I think I do real medicine. And when I do something that I'm just doing it because it works. Well, that's like every clinician who took aspirin and gave it for something else besides a headache. I mean, or pain. You know, they're doing it.
I guess that in those days that may have been alternative medicine, because it wasn't considered mainstream medicine,
right.
But that's how innovation proceeds, is that you step a little bit out of the box and you use therapies that, you know, are creative or innovative. And then the science eventually catches up and substantiates it.
Well, and I think here's the thing also, is that we have to be willing, and I say we when we try something, we have to be willing to say when the science catches up with us, it's a different explanation. For example, I just interviewed Dr. Gervasio Lamas, who
yes.
did the 10-year study, the TAC trial on chelation therapy.
And just let me interrupt, for our Intelligent Medicine podcast listeners, we did an entire podcast on the subject of the chelation trial. I didn't speak to Dr. Lamas, but in future I will. But, this is, I think, a really interesting example of the study in a rigorous way by mainstream science of something that was once considered alternative. So go ahead, Kirk.
Well, that interview is actually on my homepage.
Yes.
The lead interview.
I recommend it very highly. It's a great interview.
So the point was, I wanted to take somebody who was a non-believer, you know, who poo-pooed chelation therapy, who published in JAMA, and let's see what he says. And basically, you know, there was some benefit to chelation therapy, 18% reduction in cardiovascular events, procedures, et cetera, in those who had previously had MIs. And then there was a special group of who were diabetics and or who had a particular type of heart attack who had a 40% reduction. Now, when I asked Dr. Lamas, I said, okay, you know, I rattled off how I've been told chelation works. And, is it because of micronutrients improving myocyte function? Is it mobilizing calcium in the plaque? Is it mobilizing heavy metals? Is it affecting blood rheology? You know, how does chelation really work? And, you know, he didn't know either. And he said, you know, I think maybe heavy metals is the issue. So, but here's a hardcore scientist and a cardiologist, and he says, you know, there is something here. Now, the question is, this is where I might differ with some of my integrative medicine colleagues, is, you know, what's the best approach to reversing vascular disease? Is it a procedure that you're going to have to get, 30, 40, 50 of that helps, or do you change your lifestyle? And that's where I think, you know, me, it's lifestyle first. You know, I think vascular disease can be reversed. So,
right. So you're, I mean, I think I know where you're coming from. You're saying, you know, why go through an elaborate process if you're not going to follow proper lifestyle measures, which are cheaper and ultimately more effective?
Absolutely. And, you know, he said a very interesting, he's a very insightful kind of guy. What he said was here. So I said, well, how are you going to take this information? He goes, well, we need some drug company to take chelation and put it in a pill.
Yeah.
And add it to the armamentarium of all the other pharmaceuticals. And I just sat there in my chair and I liked the guy. You know, and I just shook my head. I just go, okay.
Well, I think what he's saying, you know, look, I personally administer chelation therapy, and I've been involved
right.
in giving chelation therapy for decades. You know, perhaps since we've known each other in the 1980s, and it takes the exceptional patient to do this. It's a process that is time consuming. It can be expensive. There's absolutely no insurance coverage for it. And so he's just being realistic. He's, you know, to the question, will chelation therapy take America by storm? Will all the cardiologists be administering it in their offices? The answer is probably not. And part of it's from bias. I mean, they still can't get their head around something as bizarre sounding as that. Part of it's economics, medical economics, because until you create a drug that can easily be monetized, it's not likely that something like this is gonna take off. But, you know, at the very least, you know, here's an honest researcher, the guy's open-minded, and he started out with intense skepticism, as you say. You can actually, hear the interview, a great interview, with Dr. Gervasio Lamas, on your website. Mention your website again, please.
Yeah, if you go to my website, prescription, like the prescription pad, 2000.com, that's prescription2000.com, a little quick burp. You'll see the podcast right down the middle of the page, and there's an archive you can go to. There's about 80. And I would like to say I link up. One of the things I've done that is also an educational tool to simplify things is on my toolbar you'll see current research, and there'll be a thing called Expert Pearls. And those 1,000 interviews that I've done on the VitaSearch site, I've actually taken a one-liner out, like the absolute guts of it, the two or three sentence guts, and I put it under the disease category there. Like if you looked under asthma, I would have probably, you know, 15 or 20 one-liners. And what I do is, at the bottom, there's a reference, but I link it to number one, the PubMed abstract, two, the summary in VitaSearch, and three, the big interview. So a person, if let's say they're a layperson, they could get the two or three lines and figure something out. But if they're a doctor, they could read the whole interview, they could read the PubMed abstract, or they could do the summary. And so that's it's on my toolbar under current research called Expert Pearls, but it's something that I'm really proud of because it really makes life simple for some people if they want to access that research.
Well, you know, I got to say, you know, you're such a dedicated and scrupulous and honest researcher. It must irk you that a lot of the popular trends are generated in a much less rigorous way. You know, something that might be casually mentioned on the Dr. Oz show, suddenly, you know, 1,000 websites appear and people are clamoring for it in the health food stores based on a scintilla of evidence that doesn't really pass muster. And yet some of the things that you talk about and are so well substantiated scientifically barely escape notice by mainstream medicine and by the media.
You know, it is so overwhelming, the internet at times, that maybe that's a good thing because I don't get caught up in that because I'm working so hard on some of the simpler things in life, and I've evolved too. I still practice every day. You know, I see patients like you, and we do chelation therapy here, you know, and
I think it's good to be in practice because you're confronted with the day-to-day dilemmas that patients bring to you and sometimes the questions that they have about, you know, is this supplement okay or not okay, and you get to try things out in a real-world laboratory.
Oh, that's the beauty of it. I mean, of course, you know, no study can tell you how to practice medicine. It's just, you know, you might remember it in the back of your head and say, well, maybe we'll try this, but we'll try it at the dose that I think is reasonable, or, you know, so it gives you some more ideas. Yeah, I mean, practice makes the research, and that's probably one of the reasons there were times where maybe as a business model it would have been better for me to give up seeing patients because then I could put my whole heart and soul into it and maybe do it better as a business. But I don't want to just compile information if it can't be related to, number one, my passion is you, the doc. I mean, my goal was to spoon feed busy docs good, credible information so they could apply it in the trenches and then, you know, tweak it the way they want. And that's still a big part of why I do what I do, is that, you know, the doctors are the interface. They have to take, you know, the real person in here who is emotionally upset, who has no money, who, you know, all the things that go with a patient.
Yeah, there are these studies, and the studies are done under pristine laboratory conditions, but in the real world it gets messy, and patients sometimes don't comply, they don't respond the way that lab rats respond in studies, you know, and it's not a perfect world.
Yeah, and then you have to apply it. So my goal was always, I have to build trust with the physicians that would subscribe or whoever reads my stuff. And I have to make it so if an outside person looked at it who was skeptical, at least they couldn't say that I didn't take it from a real source. But you want to make it simple for the physician so he can, in that moment of interaction between the patient, he's going to go, okay, I trust Kirk or whoever, and to apply this information in the way that I see fit in this particular situation. And that makes me happy when I hear a physician do that.
Okay, I want to talk about something very fundamental, which is concerns about the very nature of scientific research and the possibility that some scientific research just leaves us more confused or yields results that have no real-world application. A case in point, a recent study on fish oil suggesting that there was a relationship between fish oil and prostate cancer, in the face of so much other research that says that omega-3 fatty acids are protective against cancer. You know, if you just looked at the studies and practice medicine based on, you know, this study says that study says this. I mean, we see this with drugs all the time. Sometimes drugs work great in studies, and then a few years later we discover they're not so great and they have unacceptable side effects.
Well, I have a variety of thoughts on that. I tend to be more of a lower dose oil guy now as I get older. I'm a plant-based vegan and I tend to be low on the oils. But here's what I'd like to say about that in arguing
about the nature of a scientific research as a guide to daily practice.
Well, I think here's an interesting thing. I think I you know, the whole thing about nutritional pharmacology, I love it. My original thought was, you know, I'd rather take a nutrient and use it as a drug, to be truthful, and use it in a particular situation. I think, like, for example, take the carnitine issue. I don't know whether that wasn't actually due to supplementing carnitine. That was just due to serum levels of carnitine that they made that gross statement.
That's another one. That's the carnitine is bad for you study. I'm talking about the fish oil prostate cancer one.
Right, excuse me, the fish oil one. But they just measured, well, there was one that they just measured levels of fatty acids. They didn't give fish
exactly,
oil.
Exactly, exactly. You've seen all the critiques, and that was, I think, one of the major ones.
Right.
Is that just a blood measurement done once that, you know, may mean nothing in terms of the actual consumption of those things.
Correct. They weren't supplementing with fish oil. So that has to be taken into consideration. But I lost my train of thought.
just to redirect it, because I think I threw a lot at you there. The paradigm that I think you operate from, and a lot of science-based complementary medicine doctors operate from. You know, we're not wizards. You know, wearing wizard hats or, you know, tie-dyed T-shirts and have long beards. You know, we're trained medically. We believe in the scientific paradigm. We look at research. We look at double-blind, placebo-controlled studies as a guide to what we should be doing. But I got to say that the general public sometimes very frustrated because this one study says one thing, one study says another. You know, can we pin our hopes on good science and properly designed studies to always give us the answer?
No, you can't. There's two thoughts running through my mind. The one is, when you use a nutrient, for example, I just was doing an article on a researcher using carnitine to increase the sperm in infertile men.
Right.
Be more active, and because it's either antioxidant or improves energy production in the sperm, then you increase fertility. Now, that works in a study, or like the septic one, it might work in those sepsis patients. But that doesn't mean that if you give carnitine long term, when it was used as a drug in the study, and you give it long term, that it won't have adverse side effects. For example, if it does increase TMAO, which is the compound in the gut that may increase atherosclerosis. So you may, in other words, you can use a nutrient. If we're studying it like a drug and we use a nutrient and it has a biochemical effect, that doesn't mean that we can give it for 3 years straight.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we kind of, you know, find out with drugs all the time. And I think we're going to find that out with nutrients, that there's some things you give as a therapy, but it may not be at that high dose for long periods of time. It is safe. But mm-hmm. we're not going to know that until we go over a cliff together a little bit. I mean, that's just the way it is, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one thing about nutrients I think we'll see more of. I think that also the one thing is that, see, as much as pharmaceuticals are driven by money, so are nutrients. They're a big part of practice that we sell. There are companies that, you know, will take information and run with it, mm-hmm. and they know people will buy it. And it feeds the biggest problem that I see is that the whole point of my book is that we can reverse the biggest killers on the planet by simple dietary change really quickly. And that's the best healthcare reform in the world. And yet, I'll have a person in here, for example, who will come in and say, I want chelation therapy. And I'll take some time to spain several books. Let's say call the Lesser Times book, the program that President Clinton followed on reversing heart disease for $17. And he'll know he'll pay somewhere between $100 and $150 for chelation for 30 of them for his vascular disease. Something like that. He'll choose to do, now it's his choice, but he'll choose to do the chelation versus lifestyle. And what I mean, and when, the second part of that is I think patients, as much as they talk about lifestyle and our practices, the truth is they'd rather take a supplement to fix themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, you know, that's interesting because at the end of a career where you've dedicated yourself to the scientific study of supplements, it seems that you've had an epiphany and that you've come back to a very simple and fundamental approach emphasizing diet and exercise and maybe, you know, conservative supplementation. It all comes down to some very simple measures to preserve your health. That's the theme in staying healthy in the fast lane, 9 simple steps to optimal health.
Well, there's no question. In fact, it's an autobiography kind of in myself. But, you know, we have a healthcare crisis, and when I give my talks, you know, the World Health Organization said, you know, that if we just did diet, lifestyle, and avoided tobacco, that we could wipe out 80% of heart disease, 80% of diabetes, 80% of stroke, and 40% of cancers. And if you look at our healthcare, and this gets into the politics, but if you just sit down and we look at healthcare reform, the only healthcare reform that can work is not a new model of how we treat people. It's a model that incentivizes people staying well.
Right.
Because 75% of our enormous healthcare budget, which is around 18% of our gross national product, is to the chronic diseases that are lifestyle driven. So that means in a perfect world, if we all exercised right and lived right, et cetera, we could probably knock out 12% of our gross national product. We could save, that's 75% of the 18, by just changing our lifestyles. But the problem is there's no economic incentive
right.
at all.
Well, you know, they talk about how the economy has to keep growing and growing and growing. And if we said to everybody, just buy a funky little car that's great on mileage and, you know, can go maximum 68 miles per hour on the expressway, you know, I think a lot of people wouldn't be happy with that. And the same thing is when we're talking about our medical system, we really don't want to shrink it. We want to expand it. This new, call it Obamacare, call it the Affordable Care Act, it's basically an entitlement program for the pharmaceutical industry and for not doctors so much because they're going to get the short end of the stick, but for the big medical organizations that are going to organize and deploy doctors to treat, you know, more people who are now going to be covered, but they'll get more drugs, they'll get more therapies and treatments, perhaps unnecessarily, and the moral hazard in terms of taking care of yourself will be eliminated for a lot of people because they'll be covered regardless.
But I agree with you. But here's where I think we need to be intellectually honest in integrative medicine. If integrative medicine was paid for, ours would be somewhat less costly. It would be somewhat less harmful. But it still wouldn't necessarily get people well if people rely on, let's say, chelation therapy and nutrients to get them well when they have to really change their diet and get some exercise and do some mind-body stuff. It's the same. I always tell people, if for the healthcare system to change or we're going to go bankrupt, we have to somehow make it more profitable to keep people well, or the powers that keep people well have to be bigger than the powers that treat when we're sick. And that's the challenge because, you know, I had an interesting thing. You know that you have a business and healthcare premiums were going up. We have a small practice here. It's a small business, 14 people. And I remember when I turned 55, the lady comes in annually every year to tell us how much our healthcare is going to cost, and the boss is pulling his hair out because he has to cut back a little bit each year. And when I was 55, my healthcare premium from United Healthcare was $5.95. She hands me this booklet for the year. Halfway through the year, she gave me another booklet when I turned 56, and it went up to 7 something. Now, why does that happen? Because
they should simply take a look at the picture of you on the cover of your book, because looking at you, you look buff and you don't look a day over 45 in that picture. So
right, I know, but the point is that we are all in this together because it's the average. Insurance premiums are built off the average. So if the average 55-year-old has, you know, is taking 5 medicines, I'm thrown in that boat. And what I'm trying to get at, there's no incentive except for logic, and we're all going to go bankrupt together because we all pay for it. I mean, that's the two things for me is, one, I want to keep myself healthy, but two is, if I help other people healthy, sooner or later, that's the only way we can reduce our healthcare costs. But anyway, you go on. I can get off on this topic because it drives me nuts.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of, you know, other than you spoke about your great interview with Dr. Lamas, what are some of the other interviews you've done recently that have gotten you really excited about some new finding in the field of nutritional medicine?
Well, you know, Ron, it usually isn't, to be truthful, it usually isn't a new nutraceutical. I am more, if you look at my podcast, they're biased, and they're biased towards lifestyle people mm-hmm. who can say, for example, Caldwell Esselstyn is a Cleveland Clinic surgeon who used to be a breast cancer surgeon, a thyroid surgeon, and he got tired of doing breast cancer surgeries because he felt like he wasn't doing anything to help people prevent disease. And so anyway, he goes on a worldwide search and finds out that, you know, there are certain areas in the world where you don't have prostate cancer, you don't have breast cancer, but you don't have heart disease, the number one killer. So way back in the 80s when Dean Ornish was doing his, you know, plant-based work with the vegetarian diet and heart disease and reversal, he was doing it at the Cleveland Clinic, and he took, I forget, I want to say 25 or something like that of the sickest heart disease patients that they wouldn't touch anymore. They wouldn't do procedures on. And he put them on a very strict plant-based diet. I mean, this is a no oil, four food grouper, you know, plant-based diet. And then 12, 14 years later, you know, they have very few events. And that's where President Clinton, you know, did his thing. He started to follow that and some Dean Orners. And my point is that those things excite me because those are the things that are going to save our healthcare system. We have to prevent disease, and the whole world has to do it. China has more chronic disease than we do. 8 out of 10 deaths in China are from chronic disease. We have 7 out of 10 deaths. The world has 6 out of 10 deaths. India has the highest rate of diabetes in the world, and it all goes with economics. It all goes with the Western lifestyle.
I don't want to get into a debate about the effects of an animal-based diet versus a plant-based diet, but since you follow all these articles and you're always on top of the latest developments, you're probably aware of a new article that appeared in the most recent issue of American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and it was entitled Meat Intake and Cause-Specific Mortality, a Pooled Analysis of Asian Prospective Cohort Studies. And what they found was rather perplexing for advocates of a purely plant-based diet. They said, you know, in the background of the study, they said, well, total red meat intake has been shown to be associated with a higher risk of death in Western populations, but little is known of the risks in Asian populations. And what they found was that there actually was an inverse relationship between total meat and seafood consumption and the risk of all-cause cardiovascular disease or cancer mortality among men and women. You know, what that does, it throws a little bit of a wrench into the argument of people who argue for a vegan diet simply on the basis of that elimination of meat is the answer. I know there's refinements to this because we also look at the insulin connection, looking at carbohydrate consumption. And my problem with some vegans is when they replace meat with starchy carbohydrates, they send their insulin up and they create higher risk for metabolic syndrome. I'm sure you're aware of that argument.
Well, we could debate that. I'd go in.
That's not. That's,
but here's what. Here's
that
what
would
I
be
would
for
say.
Another podcast.
Yeah. Well, here's what I would say. First of all, here's one of my biggest things in a plant-based diet. And the person, by the way, that wrote the foreword to my book is David Jenkins, who invented the glycemic index. Okay.
Yes.
He's the man. All right. MD,
yep.
PhD, doctor of science. Well, he happens to be a vegan. But here's what he interestingly said. He's a vegan, not because of the totality of health, okay? In other words, it's a good diet. I think you can be healthy, and if you read my book, you can be healthy as a meat eater, and you can be healthy as a vegan, okay? Everybody would agree that we have to eat more unprocessed plant food.
Yeah, I'm totally there with you on that. I think
Right. Even
if you're going to be eating a diet that includes ample amounts of animal protein, you absolutely have to have plenty of fresh vegetables and low glycemic index fruits. We're on the same page there.
Now, where we would disagree is that I think, well, let's just leave it at that for the moment. Here's where, when I interviewed Lauren Cordain, by the way.
Who is a proponent of the Paleolithic diet,
yeah,
which is 60% high in animal protein.
60% animal food diet. Mm-hmm. And here was the thing that struck me when I heard him at the ACAM meeting. He said, he was asked by Jonathan Collins in a kind of a tongue-in-cheek way, well, should we feed buffalo to our school children? And what he said was, and he believes his diet's the paleo diet's the optimal diet. He said, it's not sustainable. You cannot sustain it and feed the world. Mm-hmm. And here's my biggest point. We have to come up, the world has to come up with a dietary pattern that does four or five things. And this is what, David Jenkins said. And I'm very proud that he wrote the fourth book. He said, number one is you have to prevent and reverse the chronic diseases. We know that can be done with a strict plant-based diet. It's unquestionable. And I know it could be done with small amounts of animal food and an unprocessed rest of plant-based diet. I mean, basically, I know you eat a clean diet. You can reverse heart disease that way if you had a small amount of animal food. Now, I would disagree on a lot, but and plant food. So it's not that you have to do one or the other, but how are you going to sustain? I ask this to all my colleagues, all my brothers and sisters that are integrative medicine people or are hooked on paleo or hooked on meat and vegetables. How are you going to sustain a world that is approaching 9 billion people if they all start eating animal food in the same way? It's not possible. You'll have to cut down more rainforest. You'll have to – and so you have to have a pattern that can be accessible to everyone, which a plant-based diet can. It has to be able to reverse the chronic diseases, which we know a plant-based diet can, from diabetes to heart disease to obesity. And it has to not rip the ecology of the planet. And, you know, you can – I don't know how you're going to have free-range animals and cut down – I mean, where are you going to feed them? Where are you going to put them?
I think that that's a point well taken. And as a real strong example of that, I shop at Whole Foods from time to time. And the other night I was there and I got myself the premium organic grass-fed ground beef and a few other items. And then I went up to the cashier to pay my bill. And it was $48 to my relative dismay. And perhaps it would be ideal for people to go back to a Paleolithic diet, but for each and every man, woman, and child on the planet to have ample quantities of really high-grade grass-fed, pasture-fed meat would pose some real challenges.
Well, so, I would also say this, though, that even if you accept that, if you look at the longevity cultures in the world, they're not vegan. I get it, okay? They're not vegan. From the Okinawan centenarians, which is one of my favorite studies because they're still studying to the day, the Wilcox brothers and Dr. Suzuki. They do not eat a whole ton of animal food. It's small amounts, and they are big carbohydrate eaters. And so it doesn't set well. And I have those YouTubes on my homepage. You really like to look at a culture who their children and grandchildren are rampantly having our diseases, living in the same location with the same genes, but because the elders live a particular lifestyle, which includes a lot of plant food and small amounts of animal food, they don't get these diseases. So I don't think the paleo diet is a totally healthy diet. I think it gets people off grains that are refined and processed, and that's why a lot of people feel better.
Well, you know how we're going to ultimately settle this is I'll arm wrestle you. Okay, I know that you're on the West Coast out near Sacramento. I'm here on the East Coast, New York City, but we'll get together somewhere in Chicago, and we'll have a tournament. I don't want to digress too far into that subject, but anyway, the point being, I want to leave it at that, but let's recommend your book, Staying Healthy in the Fast Lane. And how can people get a hold of the book?
Well, here's a great deal. It's for free.
Oh,
go to my website, you'll see a picture of that cover. And when you order it, for right now, you click on the cover and it'll say order. It will say no charge. And it'll be it's $5.50 to ship it to you. But I don't charge for the book because I'm going to pack it and ship it to people. And it's very simple. I want to build a list of people that know my work. And if I break even on the book, that's good because my book, I think, is very fair. I give Lauren Cardena my book about 5 pages, by the way. And I think if you read the model, the biggest theme is we have to prevent disease in a busy world. And so my 9 simple steps are like I was sharing with you. I went and did my yoga 10 minutes on a tennis court before I ran out from work and did it. I mean, I learned how to do things very quickly. So I have a model of 9 steps of how to do 3 diet steps, 3 exercise steps, 3 mind-body steps. Because it's one thing to live, you know, in a spa area and have great food brought to you. But it's another thing being a busy mom of 3 kids and trying to apply principles to keep you healthy, or a stressed out father of 4 kids. So the book is about, the last part is about how to do it in a busy world. The first part is, what are chronic diseases? The middle portion is, can we reverse them? So if you don't like the first two, just read the back part. It tells you how to do it, from back pain to eating quickly out, fast food, to everything.
Okay, and it's prescription2000.com. And the real nutrition aficionados and healthcare professionals, vitasearch.com is
right,
where they can find your great interviews. And also, it's a great search engine where you can find all kinds of nutrition articles.
Well, it's linked to my site. So on my right-hand side of my homepage are educational handouts of just things I give patients. The left side is educational links. And right there is a link to VitaSearch. And there's also a link directly to the interviews. And they're called expert interviews. So if you go to my site, you just look on the left-hand side, you can link right over to VitaSearch, and also the expert pearls, if you get into those one-liners, they'll link over to VitaSearch.
Okay, great. So awesome work. Kirk, and you know, I really feel a debt of gratitude towards you because you provide me with lots of grist for the mill for subjects that I share with my listeners. And so, you know, keep eating that brown rice and tofu because it's working for sure for you.
Yeah. Well, the brown rice. If I keep eating the tofu, I lose my brains, my testicles will fall off.
So that's an interesting wrinkle is that you're not a big soy fan. That's a whole different subject.
No. I am a whole food soy supporter.
Okay.
I would gladly debate that one. And okay. Just go look at the Okinawan centenarians.
Okay. Fine. It's they're not eating commercialized.
No, they're not. No, that's a different
refined
animal.
Refined soy products.
You know, let me ask you something.
Yeah.
As a source, it's very interesting. Soy has more charge to it than almost anything.
Oh my God! There's so much controversy about soy. It's like
and here's my question to you as an intelligent person. So when I say, as long as you're not sensitive to it, I say eat whole soy foods, and all of a sudden people are talking to me like I'm saying the manipulated GMO stuff that you put in a hamburger. And I go, where did that come from? I'm talking about miso. I'm talking about a tofu. I'm talking about tempeh. You know what I mean? And everybody jumps to that when I just say that. So I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a highly charged issue. We could do an entire podcast on the subject of soy. Is it, you know, Darth Vader or is it the salvation of the world? People, you know, are very, very hot and heavy on that one. So with that, I want to thank you very much and keep up the great work. Kirk Hamilton, thanks very much for joining us on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast and congratulations on your new book.
Thanks so much, Dr. Hoffman, and keep up the great work. And maybe we'll do this when we're 80, right?
Yeah, indeed. We'll do it. We'll do a reprise every 30 years or so.
All right. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you Take very care. Much, Kirk. Bye-bye. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks very much for joining us. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.